Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mush, You Huskies. This is day three of our Iditarod coverage, and I am hosting from Willow, Alaska. Our co-host, Michelle, cannot join us this evening. She is teaching classes at our dog training school in Denver, but on the line, I do have our co-host for our Iditarod coverage, Jason Barron, calling in from Lincoln, Montana. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us. I know that you just said before we went on that you've been out and about today running errands and taking care of things, but things are developing very quickly in the Iditarod. What do you have for an update right now, if you have anything special?
Well, you know, it's like I said yesterday, that this truly becomes an event that happens 24 hours a day. There's always going to be something to talk about. There's always going to be more stuff happening than we could possibly talk about. Right now, the action's heating up. The race is following a fairly predictable pattern in terms of the competition. The drivers, the top contenders, pretty much did as I had expected. And we talked about this last night. They pulled into – some of them went past Squintna, the 70-mile mark of the race. Some of them went a few miles past and camped for the night. And when I say for the night, I mean a 5 or 6 hour break. The top drivers, like Lance Mackey, who is the 4-time defending champion of the Iditarod, he stopped. In my opinion, he's kind of setting the competitive – he's where everybody's queuing off of right now, and he stopped for a 4-hour, almost on the dot, a 4-hour break, which is, you know, it's kind of minimal, but it gets the job done at Squintna, and then he pushed, I don't have his trail time in front of me, but it probably took him about 8.5 hours to get from Squintna through Finger Lake and on over to Rainy Pass, which is up in the Alaska range, and there he stopped for, I love how he's doing this, he was the first driver in, and I'm so impressed with how well he got over there, and then what he did once he was there, he took a solid 6-hour break, which in top dog mushing parlance is a solid rest. I mean, that's the equivalent of an overnighter for us, and some of his competitors actually caught him there at the checkpoint and took shorter breaks and took off in front of him. One of them is a guy I predict will be very tough to be and possibly a real contender to win the Iditarod is Paul Gebhardt, who did the same thing. He took a 4-hour break back in Squintna, same as Lance, drove to Rainy Pass, the same as Lance, but he only took a little bit over 4 hours, and he doesn't have the literal lead, but he's definitely a little ways in front of Lance right now. There's a fellow named Robert Bunsen, who I don't have his tracker information, but he's actually leading the Iditarod. He's driving a team, he and Zach Steer. I believe I don't want to be incorrect talking here, but he has a connection with Zach Steer, who is a top Iditarod musher. And Zach's not in the race this year, so I suspect that Robert is running the team that Zach has ran before. Top team, potentially a winning team. And Robert is in the official lead with Paul Gebhardt. I'm looking at this right now. Paul Gebhardt is out, right, not too far behind him, and then Ray Reddington Jr., and then Lance Mackey, Hugh Neff, Martin Boozer, Sebastian Schnell, and Hans Gott.
That's pretty much up-to-the-minute information there, and I'm sure people will listen to this show throughout the evening. So make sure that you can follow this at your leisure. And Jason wrote a great blog about that this morning about, you know, where to decipher all of your information, and a great spot to do it. If you haven't signed up for the Iditarod Insider, that's probably the best place. But another great location is ADN.com, Anchorage Daily News, the newspaper up here in Anchorage. They do wonderful coverage of it, and that's what I'm reading right now online. So if you can, just follow it as you go, and as Jason was saying, it is a 24-hour race, and things change very quickly. But with that, Jason, I'm sitting here reading an article that was posted at 3 p.m. on the Alaska Daily News website, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday, about loose dogs. And it appears that Martin Boozer got in a tangle with the Jamaican musher, Newton Marshall, up on the trail near Finger Lake. And the tangle you know, caused a pretty good problem there, and five of Martin's dogs got loose there at that point, and two of those dogs ended up running into the Finger Lake checkpoint, and then the other three hitched a ride with Ken Anderson and his team. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Tell us about that spot of the Iditarod and why a tangle would happen with,
let me just clarify.
Such distance between, mushers. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, sorry. There's a little bit of feedback on my end, so you'll have to bear with me. Is it
okay.
Now, did it happen in Happy Valley, like at the down there in Happy River? Is that what you said?
Let's see here. I'm going ahead and reading it. A real narrow section of the trail, and Ian did some dogs to get out of the tangle, and the whole thing popped loose, and the dogs.
But it didn't say exactly where it was.
No, it didn't.
What there is, when you leave Finger Lake, look, these trails are really narrow. And remember I talked yesterday about how it was going up the Yentna, the Sioux, the Yentna, and the Squintna Rivers, like a highway, very wide. Well, when you start heading overland through the Alaska Range, where they are at now, and where they're talking about, I don't know the exact mileage location of where the event happened, but I can tell you that trail is really, really windy. So if someone's in front of you, hemmed in with high snow banks and really dense, thick trees that are all kind of snarled together and coming in really tight, so you don't have much more than the width of your dog team, the width of your sled. And if you run into a problem, like say there's someone stopped in front of you having their problem, well, their problem becomes yours because you're going to get tangled up with them if you can't see them in time or if you can't control your team. And about 12 miles from the time you leave Finger Lake, there's about a 12-mile run, and then you drop down the Happy Valley Steps. And it's four very gnarly, nasty, steep, just kind of feel like you're skydiving without a parachute kind of drops. And it's infamous. It's one of the legendary kind of obstacles in the Iditarod. And I suspect that whatever problems we're reading about originate in that area. So what would happen is if somebody was going down the Happy Valley Steps and they had a mishap on the way down, like I suspect is what happened to Martin, I don't know this for sure, I just suspect it, then what would happen is you not only would you be plugging up the trail with your dogs and your sled and your gear and just your, you know, kind of the problems you were facing, but also you would be at the bottom of a hill where whoever was coming after you could not stop. They'd just basically literally fall down on you. And it just, I hope I'm painting a picture that, you know, would scare just about anybody. It sounds to me like this is more or less what happened.
And we can only speculate at this point, but when we're talking about these tangles, for very novice mushers, they may have never had a tangle, especially if they're sprint mushers. And I'm sure you and I can both attest, when a dog team gets tangled, especially with another team, it can be not only a very difficult thing to undo that could sometimes maybe take a half an hour to get all worked out, but it's a life-changing thing for the dogs. I mean, it's threatening, isn't it?
Well, certainly with the circuit, yeah, because you got a lot of ropes. You know, these dog teams are all hooked into a central main line. It's usually a 3/8 to half inch rope with like a poly braided rope. Maybe most drivers use some cable running down it for security so it can't be easily chewed. Then there's necklines connecting the dogs' collars to the main line, and then there's tug lines connecting the back of their harness to the main line. So it's a lot of rope. So if you figure you get two 16-dog teams into each other, then if you can imagine all those dogs all piled up and all those ropes wound around, it is really easy for a dog to get, you know, to get tangled up and, you know, basically could be hurt or turned loose. And a lot of times what happens is you get in a tangle, and the reason dogs get loose out of those situations is because the driver goes in, sees a threatening situation to the safety and health of his dogs, and whips out his or her knife and starts cutting dogs loose. I mean, we call it cutting them loose. So you go in there, boom. I mean, you got your knife out, you're taking the tug lines and neck lines off, you're cutting your main line, you're doing whatever it takes to release the pressure on any dog that might be like a half hitch around their leg or something like that of that nature, or worse. And what you do is you forget about keeping your team intact, and you start cutting the lines apart to release all this pressure, and then you start worrying afterwards about how you're going to deal with, you know, about how you're going to deal with catching dogs, because it's much preferable, obviously, to have a dog running loose than a dog, you know, straightened out between between eight dogs on either side of it and getting a half hitch tightened around its midsection. You know, so your first thought is, you know, safety of the dog, and you cut them loose if that's what's required, and then you start pulling your hair out trying to figure out how to collect them all afterwards. And that's what it sounds like happened with Martin. And I mean, my heart just goes out to those guys.
And the potential for a dog fight could happen at that point too, because if dogs are compromised and wrapped up in rope and they're they're around dogs that they've never known before, there is that potential for a fight, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that potential, especially if they're in pain. I mean, everybody who's ever been around a dog before, that was injured or hurt knows, especially if the pain is ongoing, like it's, two dogs are tightened together and they're both getting squeezed, they think one is hurt, the other one's hurting it or whatever, is that, yeah, there's plenty of potential for dog fights. You know, this is a pretty extreme example. It's weird that we were talking about it. I got to tell you, this is like the first time I've heard of, these two high-profile drivers having this kind of issue, but probably the amazing thing is that it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen more often, I guess. But this is definitely one of the worst situations I've heard of this type happening in the front part of the pack.
And if we can, just to stay on this point for just a second longer, we talked about what happens to mushers if they don't have all of their dogs when they go into a checkpoint. And the report says the officials could not officially check Booser out of the checkpoint until all of the missing dogs arrived. Of course, when they did, he was allowed to go, and he went out in a hurry. But we talked a little bit about that last night. You just can't leave a dog and say, well, he'll show up, and I want to drop him anyway. So when he wanders in, we're going to fly him out.
Oh, no, not at all. No, you have that exactly right. Is it the way, in this case, it didn't probably affect his competitive plans because he pulled in, he stayed there, he was probably going to stay for 4 to 6 hours anyway. And, in this situation, is his dogs were all captured. Actually, I need to back that up a little bit. I really don't know where he stopped from his previous run. So it may have affected his plans. Well, I'll have to dig into that and see, and I'll try to come up with more information. I'll blog about this maybe tomorrow morning. But, that's exactly right. Is that your race, until you have all your dogs accounted for, your race comes to a halt. They're not going to disqualify you for not having all your dogs. They just hold you until your dogs are all, basically caught. And then basically that's what I mean by the race ends for you, is that you stop thinking about forward progress and you start thinking about collecting your dogs. Once you've got all your dogs, then you continue. And I have to just say this, these drivers like myself, Martin Boozer, Jeff King, Lance Mackey, these are people who love their dogs and consider them teammates, consider them part of their team. I mean, they love these animals and they work with them on a daily basis. And, it's a scary thing. I mean, it's like having your kids running around there loose and not knowing where they're at and probably in a dangerous situation without their papa or their mama. So, I don't really think that Martin Boozer sitting there at Rainy Pass bemoaning his fate as far as his competitive strategy goes. He's sitting there worried about his dogs.
That's exactly right. Jason, if I could, I'm going to put you on hold real quick. I've got quite a bit of feedback, and I'm going to bring you back on here. It's only going to take about 5 seconds, so hold on, please. And Jason, are you there?
I am still.
All right, so let's talk about the news of the day. The big news is 5-time Iditarod champion Rick Swenson. And we talked just a second ago about Happy River Valley and those steps. And it appears, according to Alaska Daily News, that he could have potentially broke his collarbone on a crash right there. And with that, he's saying that he might have to scratch. Of course, there is no information right now that he has. But can you tell us about that? How bad of an injury is a broken collarbone on a race like this?
Well, I can tell you that the Iditarod is it's really tough to complete under the best of circumstances. And I've never personally had my collarbone broken, but my wife has, and I can tell you that it's unlikely, if it's a true fracture, if they've diagnosed it correctly and that's what it is. I mean, if it turns out maybe it's just he just got hit really hard and it hurts, then that's probably something he can, kind of work himself out of. But if it's bone grating around in there, then his race is probably over. I would think it's, and I'll say this too, you might have some young gun that wants to go out there and never have finished the Iditarod, wants to prove that they can tough it out, and that's one thing. You might think that they might kind of limp it along, but what you said was, Rick Swenson's kind of nearing, I would think, the twilight of his career. He's a 5-time Iditarod champion. He's one of the most sort of the epic figures of Iditarod folklore. I mean, his legacy is assured. Nobody will ever doubt. I mean, Rick Swenson doesn't need to be doing any of this. He's got nothing to prove. So, my advice to Rick would be, hey, buddy, we all love you. We all know you're a tough guy. man, don't kill yourself trying to get to know him just to prove anything to me or any of the rest of us, because we know who and what you are, one of the greatest champions that's ever stood in the back of a set of dog runners, and you don't have nothing to prove.
He is 60 years old, according to the report. So, like you said, he is probably in that twilight of his career, and we hope the best for Rick, and we hope that it isn't anything major, and he can continue on. But with that, Jason, what type of medical care is available for the mushers? Are there medical technicians like EMTs or none?
None. You know, at a big checkpoint like McGrath, you know, you may have it's what we call an airfield hub. There's a clinic there. I think in Nicolai they might have a small clinic. It's open for a few hours a day, you know, so if you hit it at the right time. But where they're at is a bush checkpoint. There's not much there besides some kind of lodge. I'm not sure what they cater to, but it's a sort of a tourism kind of based lodge there in Pass, and that's it. So, you know, there's veterinarians. If someone was cut open and bleeding to death, they could throw a tourniquet on them. But essentially what's going to happen is somebody who's hurt really bad is going to be stabilized the best of the volunteers and the checkers, you know, just normal people's ability to stabilize them. And then they're going to be thrown on a plane and flown back to Anchorage where they can receive medical attention. You know, this is a tough race. You get hurt out there, you cut your finger off trying to, you know, you're busting up some meat for your dogs with your axe at 30 below, and you know, you're holding it, kind of trying to balance, you know, trying to keep the meat, you know, where you can, and I've actually seen this, you know, the meat where you can actually bust it open with your axe and break it apart into little patties. And I saw a guy one time, he hit himself in the finger with his, axe. And it was, you know, just one of those stupid mistakes that we do, you know, to get ourselves accidents, hurt ourselves. And, you know, he about cut his finger off and boom, he's out of the race. I mean, me and a couple other kids, I was just a kid at the time and watching him at a checkpoint, me and about two other people had to work like the devils to not really tourniquet his finger, but we had to work really hard to put all kinds of bandages on it while he was bleeding profusely. And, you know, it's tough. If you get hurt bad enough, you're going home. I mean, there's not a lot of medical help for the drivers. Now, with that said, the dogs have lots of medical attention out there. There's probably 5 or 6 world-class veterinarians from all over the world. Veterinarians have been doing this for years. Some of the best vets I've ever been around at every single checkpoint. So it's a completely different story for the dogs. I mean, the dogs have as much care as they need, whereas the humans, they're out of luck.
Right. And I know Jerry Vanek, the vet, he is also a wilderness EMT guy, and he will be joining you guys when he finishes the serum run further down, those guys, the mushers, further mm-hmm. down on the trail. But like you said, that's far and few between is, you know, vet care is a heck of a lot different than human care in terms of injury. So we hope the best for anybody that does get injured. And like you said, Rick Swenson has nothing to prove to anybody, so we wish him well. So, Jason, we have about 10 minutes left. What do you want to cover today?
Well, I guess we can go back to the competition. I think it's interesting. It's playing out nicely. At this point, I think Lance Mackey is he always deviates his schedule a little bit in terms, if you want to be technically specific, you know, sometimes he doesn't stop in Squintna. Sometimes he might stay there for 2 hours and then run on over to Finger Lake and then take a break there and continue. But when I say this, he's doing the same thing he usually does. I mean that in the broader picture. He covered the ground he needed to get shut down before the heat of the day near the Rainy Pass area, and then took the right amount of rest. In my opinion, he's sitting in the catbird seat, because even though Paul Gebhardt and Ray Reddington Jr. are in front of him, they've taken a lot less rest. And one thing that I think a lot of people, and I've seen this on a lot of the mushing sites where the fans are kind of weighing in on this, get too wrapped up in where people are statistically, where exactly they are and how fast they're going, as opposed to the one thing that the website and the data streaming off the various, you know, ADN, stuff we're talking about, my blog, the leaderboard, GPS, these things can't tell you how good a person's dogs look. I can almost guarantee you Lance Mackey, when he was ready to go here after a six-hour break at a Rainy Pass, his dogs were barking and screaming just like they're going to be coming down Front Street in Nome. And you know, just because you're in front of Lance doesn't necessarily mean, and it's not necessarily a good thing if you're cutting rest to do it and your dogs don't look as good as his, because all he's going to do is just sort of follow along and wait till you are weak, in a weakened state, and then he's going to be blowing past you. And you know, and then what happens is these drivers who push hard to try to match his pace or maybe even try to outpush him end up with teams that just can't hold it together, and they get tired too early in the race and, you know, have a hard time, you know, we call it limping into Nome. I mean, basically they lose all control of their own fate and they end up reacting to the race the rest of the way. And it's certainly been the case with several of my races. So I'm speaking from personal experience. So what I urge people who are listening to this and watching the race is really look at what the drivers are doing, and don't, you know, keep in mind that you run for 8 hours with a dog team and only take a 4-hour break, that your dog team probably isn't rested as if they're fresh and they're, you know, they're back at home in, you know, in a home situation, you know, taking an overnight rest between training runs. And I feel that Lance Mackey made such a pro move, and I just wanted to really focus on that. I'm looking for him to, by taking a couple hours longer than his nearest competitors. And what I would say is I'm looking for him, I don't know how cold it is out there, but if it's really cold, like in the 30 below type of range, then he'll probably stay in Roan. He'll pull in a Roan and take a modest break and then run across the burn and end up out there at Nicolai. And that'll be sometime tomorrow, kind of in the mid-morning. If it's not too cold, then he may choose to pick up a bale of straw, some fuel for his cooker, and some extra food for his dogs, and run through Roan and go about 2 hours out to Egypt Mountain. There's a little creek out there the drivers like to stop at, and they do a little bush camp, and in which case he would take a similar amount of rest that he would have taken in Roan, and then go on from there after 5 or 6 hours on from there to Nicolai. The only practical difference, and I just blogged about that before we went on this show, the only practical difference would be preference of campsite and, you know, the fact that if they run to Egypt Mountain, they've broken the run maybe a little bit more in half instead of the total distance between Rainy Pass and Nicolai, as opposed to maybe a third of the distance going to Roan and then having to do two-thirds of the run. Than, you know, leaving Roan, going to Nicolai. So I feel like guys like Lance, and I certainly have felt this way in the past, make their minds up based on just how easy it's going to be to take care of themselves and the dogs out there at that bush stop. So in other words, if it's really windy and it's just brutal cold, it's easier to stop and Roan and just take care of your dogs and yourself there. But if it's going to be zero or above and just a nice night for camping, then it can be quite pleasant to be out there in the burn away from your competitors and no one can really have a look at you, and there's advantages there too. So I'm looking for Lance to do one of those two things.
So that sounds like a great analysis there. Jason, if you will, can you tell us a little bit about the differences between the northern route and the southern route, and which is a harder way to go, if you can talk about that a bit?
Well, you know, the southern route always is southern route is much harder, and I'll tell you why. We have a few days before the race gets to that point. So for you, the audience listening, what I would say is that the split between the northern and southern routes doesn't start until the drivers leave the checkpoint of Ophir. And I'm not going to do a blow-by-blow of describing where that's at. You'll just have to get a map of the Iditarod Trail and have a look. It's a few days in front of the drivers. And from that point, you can go north or south, and the difference is this. The Iron Dog Classic, which is a snowmobile race that runs a few weeks before the Iditarod, uses the northern route. So they do a lot of improvements on the trail, and that trail is being used prior to the Iditarod coming through. So the northern route is actually kind of a highway in terms of how much usage it gets throughout the year. Also, when you start getting into you get into a pretty nice road about 30 or 40 miles outside of the checkpoint of Ruby, which is the first checkpoint on the Yukon on the northern route. So there's a lot of traffic, a lot of people coming out, a lot of the folks that, you know, live in the villages use that trail. And then when you're going down the Yukon, the wind is almost always at your back, and the trail is checkpoints are between villages. There, so there's a lot of travel between villages. So again, the trail all the way to Caltag, where the two routes come back together. They diverge at Ophir. They come back together at Caltag on the Yukon, which is I'm just going to pull this figure right out of my ear, so I might be a bit off, but it's about 140. It's about 270 miles either way. Now, here's the difference. when you run the southern route and you, the trails diverge at over, you're on a trail essentially that is put in especially just for the Iditarod. There is no Iron Dog coming through there. There is no village traffic. There's no one using it. So it is going to be usually a wind-drifted, punchy, no base. The first team or two over it might have a decent time, but for the most part, everybody else coming along has to deal with if it's a deep snow year, a punchy kind of slop. Very rough, very nasty. It's a bit longer. The geography is a little tougher getting to the Yukon. And now when you're on the Yukon, you're way south of, hence the southern route, you're way south of Caltag where the two trails come back together, and you have about 140 miles up the Yukon River. And this time, instead of the wind being at your back, it is in your face. And it is always blowing on the Yukon. There is no comparison between going down the Yukon and up the Yukon. There might as well be from the front side of the moon or the back side, which one you would want to be on.
Go ahead.
And also, there's the villages. It's not like there's a bunch of villages where we're going. The trail goes between each village, so there's a lot of good traffic on that river. It's for the most part a trail that's put in up the river all the way to Caltech just for the Iditarod. So again, the quality of the trail doesn't have even close to the same kind of base. So those are the elements. I would say the southern route is much, much more difficult than the any given year is much more difficult than the northern route.
And they run the southern route on the odd years, hence 2011, and the northern route on the even years. My last question with you, Jason, and we have about 2 minutes left, in regards to that, do rookies in particular wait out time in regards to that southern route? Say they want to run the Iditarod in 2011, but they know that's a southern route year. Have you ever heard of anybody waiting because of the southern-northern route pick?
Sure, I think that's a reasonable thing. If you're not a competitive driver and all you want to do, you know, is just run the Iditarod and get your belt buckle and say you've done it, then that's a perfectly reasonable way to do it. Go pick the easier route. I mean, it's not like it's, when I say easier, I certainly don't mean it's easy, you know, it's just easier than the southern route. The drivers who plan on becoming top drivers and want to be competitive, of course, they have to learn to deal with, you know, they have to learn to cope with everything the trail is going to throw, you know, the different routes are going to throw at them, unique challenges, you know, the challenges that are unique to each route. So what I would say is people who are non-professionals, then yeah, I mean, definitely if you're just going to pick 1 year to do it, then definitely pick the northern route. You could do yourself a favor. And also if you think you're going to be a perennial musher, it doesn't hurt to start in the northern year. But if you think you're going to be one of the top dogs and you just want a challenge and you want to know what the Iditarod's all about, don't be afraid of going to do the southern route, because you know, as long as you prepare your dogs properly, listen to the advice of your whatever patron drivers you go to get your knowledge, then you're going to get there, as long as you put one foot in front of the other and just take it easy.
There you go. Jason, I know you're a man in demand, and you're going to be on another show here in just a few minutes. Let's close right here. What do you want to end with? You got about a minute.
Well, I just want to end with wishing all the best to Martin Boozer. I think that if I heard that correctly, that you know, I hope there's no problems, you know, arising from the issue we heard about. Also, I want to note that Ken Anderson, was he the fellow who brought a couple dogs in for Martin?
Yes, I appear as three.
Okay, well, I just want to nominate him for the Sportsmanship Award right now. Ken Anderson is one of the nicest guys out there on the trail, and I'd love to see him take this one to Disneyland. And also, I just want my condolences to the friends and family of Rick Swenson. I mean, you guys are, you know, just want you to know that Rick Swenson is a hero of mine. I've known him since I was a little boy, and I've always looked up to him. And even now that I can look him in the eye, I still look up to the man. So, I mean, my heart kind of breaks for him having problems out there, and I just wish you guys all the best. And, yeah, I just let's get and with that said, let's get back to racing. We'll get into the nitty-gritty tomorrow night.
There you go. Jason Barron, 7-time Iditarod finisher and a expert blogger. Check him out on Facebook. We got to close right here. Jason, I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks,
is Robert Forto for Mush U Huskies. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow night at the same time. Goodbye.